Disclaimer, participation in this call and webinar is by express written invitation of the AHA only. Unauthorized participants and or any party that aids and abets such unauthorized participants may be subject to criminal and civil penalties under both state and federal law. Please disconnect from the call and log off the webinar if the AHA did not expressly invite your participation. Good day and welcome to the American Hospital Association, the Safe Passage Initiative Hospitals and Health Systems Impacting the Opiate Crisis Conference Call. Today's conference is being recorded. However, the Q&A session at the end of the conference will not be recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Rebecca Chicky. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Operator, thank you very much, and welcome to all of you who are on the call. It is my honor to be here today with David Schreiner, who is the CEO of KSB Hospital, and he is joined with Chief Danny Langos, Jr., who is the Chief of Police of the Dixon Police Department. And they're going to share today an initiative that they have developed and has already had a significant impact on the opioid crisis, their Safe Passage Initiative, a collaborative between the Dixon Police Department as well as KSB Hospital. But before I turn the call and the webinar over to the true reason that you're here, let me do just a bit of housekeeping. First, if any of you on the line or on the internet or on the phone are having difficulty accessing and visualizing the slides, they are available on the section's website. That address is www.aha.org/psych. That's P-S-Y-C-H. You will be landed on the section's homepage, and then you can click on the title of today's webinar, and that will take you to the homepage for this event, which will include the bios as well as the PowerPoint. So the second housekeeping is to encourage you to ask questions online as well as via the phone. If you are online using the internet to access today's webinar, the webinar tool has the ability to take questions as we are going along in the webinar. So when something hits you, please go ahead and submit. And for those of you who are dialing in on the phone, please know that at the end of the presentation itself, the operator will give instructions as to how to queue up and on the phone to ask questions. And we will touch base with you who are on the phone a couple of times during the Q&A session to check and see if there's any incoming. Finally, I want to, in advance, thank those speakers today. Today's webinar is part of an ongoing executive dialogue series that the AHA has developed to showcase hospitals and health systems who are working in their communities to impact the opioid crisis that is rampant across the country. As part of this series, we wanted to make sure that we didn't concentrate just on metropolitan hospitals and health systems. And as you will learn, Dixon, Illinois is very different from the city that is perhaps most often acknowledged in linking with the state of Illinois, Chicago. So this is a story that is going to show you that even in smaller rural communities, you can and you can make a difference, both for your community and the individuals that they serve. So with that, I will turn the call and the webinar over to David. David, CEO of KSB Hospital, please proceed.
Thank you, Rebecca, and thank you to the American Hospital Association for the opportunity for me to share with the greater hospital community what I think is the beginning of a true success story right here in Dixon, Illinois. Chief Danny Langlos has certainly been a thought leader in this space, and the work that we're going to describe to you over the next 45 minutes or so is something that we certainly hope you can use in your own communities. So let's go ahead and get started. We wanted to share with you who you're talking to. You can see that the pictures of the two of us. Danny's picture is way cooler than mine, and you'll probably see a theme there as we move through the presentation. One of the things that I'm most proud about is the program that Chief Langlois has put together is a true community partnership, and you'll hear more about that. However, with the absence of any of these partners, I don't think that our community would have realized some of the successes that we are realizing. Chief Langlois came to me early in the process, and my response from an independent community hospital was that we're taking care of the same population of people, and KSB Hospital certainly wanted to participate at whatever level we could in order to try to make this program a success. We give you a brief shot of where Dixon is. We're about 100 miles straight west of Chicago. And KSB Hospital is a 80-bed community hospital that services part of Lee and Ogle counties in the northwest part of the state. We have just under 50,000 people in our service area. And we have clinics that are scattered around, with Dixon being the hub, some of the smaller communities that are in our geographic area. I mentioned we're at 80 beds. You can see some of the statistics that are there. And one of the statistics that is maybe relevant to our topic today is our emergency department visits are rising very, very quickly. We're at 15,000 visits a year about 3 years ago, and we're on pace through the first almost 5 months of the year to hit 20,000 visits. And that's not all good news, as many of you that are in the hospital community know, because of some of the issues that we're going to be talking about today. There's a picture of the outside of KSB. We feel very fortunate to have what we feel is something of a progressive hospital in a rural community in Illinois, a view from the top, and then a nighttime view. And with that, I would like to turn this over to Chief Langlois to talk a little bit about the city of Dixon and the Dixon Police Department. Chief?
Thank you, Dave. I'd also like to thank the American Hospital Association for giving us this opportunity to share just one approach and program that we think can really change the way that we're helping people suffering from addiction, specifically heroin or other opioid addiction. The Dixon Police Department, Dixon's a town of 16,000 people. We have a department of 30 full-time sworn police officers. Like many departments, the backbone of our department is the patrol division, but we are fairly specialized in investigations and street crimes. And street crimes really focuses on drugs. And for a long time, you know, we looked at our approaches to drugs traditionally, like most police departments do across the United States, with a strong focus on arrest. And with this new program we're going to talk about today and the development of that program, it's completely changed the way we're looking at the demand side of drugs. And as David mentioned previously, none of this would be possible without several key strategic partnerships and a true community-based approach. The heroin problem is being seen everywhere in the United States. It is a national epidemic. From 2000 to 2014, nearly 500,000 people died from drug overdose deaths. Since 2000, we've seen a 200% increase in overdose deaths related to opioids, prescription pain medications, heroin. Just in 2014 alone, there were just over 47,000 overdose deaths, which is more than 1.5 times the deaths annually in the United States from motor vehicle accidents. So drug overdose now is the number one accidental cause of death, which is a major problem. 61% of the drug overdose deaths in 2014 were related to opioids, and heroin overdose deaths have more than tripled in the last 4 years. So the problem is here, and we are faced with a situation that is just going to worsen, and we know that by watching what's happening on the East Coast, that in the Midwest and across the country, this problem is going to be 5 to 10 times what it is over the next couple of years unless we take some different approaches. One thing I think is important to look at as we look at heroin addiction is that 4 out of 5 people who suffer from heroin addiction started that addiction with prescription opioid medications. A lot of times these addictions start with a back surgery or a shoulder surgery or a neck surgery, and it's a fault of nobody that this happens. And, you know, we've done a really good job lately at educating doctors, at going after people who are, you know, illegally prescribing these medications, at drug take-back programs, at statewide tracking of prescription medication, so a pharmacist knows or a doctor knows if somebody is shopping for pain pills. But as we've done that and restricted access to these people who are addicted to the pain pills, what we've done is created a natural transition to heroin. It's cheaper. There's very easy access through most communities. And so as we look at the side of restricting the opioid pain medications, we have to realize that we've got to have some type of support and help for them. Otherwise, there's going to be this natural transition to heroin.
Chief, if I can make one comment and ask the listeners to think about this. In rural communities, it's often difficult to find access to drug treatment programs. And also, especially for our primary care physicians, you can only imagine, and I'm sure many of you have heard some of the stories about how they are uncomfortable prescribing certain medications, and especially they're not sure what resources they have available and easily available for patients that are looking for treatment in our own communities or having to be transferred somewhere else. So just give some thought to how that impacts your medical staff.
Thanks, Dave. One thing that's really important with addiction, and you know, talking to medical professionals, I'm sure there's a greater understanding, is that 80% of the people who suffer from addiction have a dual diagnosis mental health disorder. So these are people that are already struggling. And I'm going to talk about our program, the numbers in our program, but what we're seeing walk through our doors and people that we're placing directly to treatment is that number is over 90%. And these are people that really need help and support, and the care and coordination is really important. So I just think it's important for people to understand that.
When I started working with the Dixon Police Department, I think I might have been open to the small-town bias that many of us might have, the idea that we're hearing about this on a daily basis in the media, but not in our community. And I know that I certainly underestimated the amount of I guess the scope of the issue in our community, and I would suggest that that's the case in many. I don't believe that Dixon is outstanding or unusual in any way from this, but I also think that the mainstream community doesn't appreciate the scope and depth of the problem, and our police officers see it on a daily basis. I asked Chief Langlois when we were discussing the topic what percent of the issues that his officers deal with on a daily basis that are related to some type of drug or alcohol basis, and the answer is very, very high, right, Danny?
Yeah, when you look at crime and related to crime, you're talking 70-80% of crime being related to drugs, alcohol, or mental health disorders and problems. And, you know, I would say that as far as critical issues facing law enforcement, addiction and mental health are the two biggest issues facing us. And if they're facing law enforcement, what that means is they're facing our communities. And so having, you know, good plans, being progressive, being proactive, eliciting those partnerships is so important to really deal with those, because nobody has enough resources on their own. And to give a little background on how everything started with a lot of, in the Safe Passage Initiative we're going to talk about, is just one portion of so many things that are happening to address and combat heroin and opioid addiction. In February of 2015, we had 3 heroin overdose deaths in 10 days. It rocked our community. It shocked our community. The faces and the ages of these young victims was just shocking. You know, the thought of a heroin addict that comes to your mind, that came to our minds at the time, was a homeless person with 3 teeth laying in an alley with a needle hanging out of their arms. You know, addiction doesn't discriminate, and a new face of heroin is a 18 or 19-year-old or a 20 to 25-year-old. This disease doesn't discriminate. And because of the origination of it and the opioid pain medications, you're seeing people from all walks of life, you know, doctors, lawyers, at times police officers. It just doesn't discriminate. And that's why as we look at this and we start to reshape to look at drugs and addiction and treat it as the disease that it is, that's going to allow the stigma to step away and for people to come forward and ask for the help they need instead of being embarrassed and ashamed and pushing that back. So in response to these deaths, KSB Hospital took the lead with the Lee County Health Department to bring together all the key stakeholders, to bring together our local outpatient treatment centers, Mississippi centers, to bring together our faith-based community, police departments, the state's attorney, probation, and this new group that had formed from this called Safe Harbor. Safe Harbor is a grassroots organization comprised of people in recovery, of people who have family members that suffer from addiction. And working together, there are so many different things that we've been able to do and accomplish, again, as a community. But one of the things we had to do was identify what were the key areas and targets that we needed to identify. And from a training that we've gone to on the East Coast, we identified these four pillars.
If I can interject one piece, Chief, one advantage that rural communities have with the agencies that you saw before is many of us are involved with so many of these agencies. I sat on our health department board for many years. Senesippi Centers that you saw on that slide is a mental health community system that I'm on the board of. And so we know each other. There are a lot of cross work between the various agencies. And I think that makes it easier for us than it might in perhaps more competitive environments.
And that's a great point, Dave, and to leverage those connections and those resources. You know, it's easy for Dave to give me a call or me to give Dave a call. You know, we're not in a huge metropolitan area. By the same token, you know, having those relationships regardless of where you're at, this can work. And we're not treatment resource rich in our area. Matter of fact, our closest detox or inpatient treatment center is an hour away, and most of the partners we use are close to 2 hours away. So that gives an idea in the background of the program. So as we looked at, when we brought everybody together, we looked at where do we need to focus our attention, and we developed the four pillars from a training we'd gone to out on the East Coast that was specifically geared towards heroin and opioids. And the four pillars are prevention, education, treatment, and enforcement. And from those four pillars and the differences that are obvious within each of them just really drives home the need to have these strategic partnerships and to have the key stakeholders at the table.
What I thought was most unique about this that Chief Langlois led is having enforcement as the fourth pillar. And many times I think that begins as the first. And that's what, in my eyes, differentiated this program from what I had heard about in other communities, is it didn't begin with an arrest. And all of us have seen what happens in our emergency departments, and that's certainly not the place that we wanted to begin the program. We wanted to intervene at a much earlier stage, and I think the program has shown some early successes in that area.
No, thanks, Dave. And it is a complete 180 from, you know, the strategies police typically employ. And those are the things that as a profession we have to look at. And I think we've done a good job as a transition on the community policing side and building those relationships. And so how do we tilt our head and look at things differently and really, you know, come together with these other strategic partners?
Chief Langlois made me aware of the emphasis that he puts on the partnership every day when he speaks with his officers before they go out into the field. And that idea of, really, I keep overusing the word partnership, but his police officers are certainly part of the answer that goes along with this. And it's really been a change in mindset for some of your officers from prior to the start of the initiative, right, Danny?
It's a complete change in mindset because I think that as a profession, and our department was no different, and, you know, over the 20 years that I've been with the Dixon Police Department, it's changed. You know, you looked at drug use as a choice, and at times it is a choice, but we're talking about people who suffer from addiction, a disease. And there's been a lot of frustration from law enforcement, from the hospital, from the health department about finding the resources because we're just not resource-rich when it comes to drug treatment. And it's tough. You never want somebody to come to your doors and not really have an answer for them or not be able to help them. And that's where we were at because we were working to try to put people into treatment over the last few years as we dealt with people, especially people who were informants that were addicted to heroin or other opioids. And it was just really hard to do, especially at the time frame and the window that we'll talk about that's so important. But that's one component of it. We talk about these strategic partnerships and the four pillars. You know, since PRISM of Lee County, the group of people we talked about came together in a year's time, because it was about a year ago now that all of this was coming to life, and all these different things are happening, we've had some incredible successes. We've hosted two community forums that have had more than 100 people at them, which is a big number for a forum in this area in a rural community. We've conducted community Narcan training and given Narcan to families who are at higher risk, to families of loved ones who suffer from addiction. We created a substance abuse hotline that was done through our faith-based. The community forum and the Narcan were led by our hospital and our health department. We have a community support group, which is, you know, much like NA or AA, but really targets opiate addiction and gives another resource. We have trained every police officer in Lee County and deployed Narcan in all the cars. We've held addiction education forums in all Lee County high schools. We brought in a partner of ours, Tim Ryan, from the Manor Recovery Foundation, somebody who's been there, who suffered from a heroin addiction for 15 years, who went to prison, who a year ago lost his son to a heroin overdose death. And not only did we come in and present to every student in the high school age, and we came back and we targeted smaller groups within those schools and provided those resources. And then the program that we're here to talk a lot about today is the Safe Passage Initiative.
One of the things that I would ask you to really give some thought to is how you can involve your faith-based community. By Chief Langlois going out to the churches, he received a very willing audience that was not only willing to listen, but able to jump in and help with the problem. And I know I was even a little bit surprised about the diversity of engagement from the different faiths. And it's in all communities, I think that's available. Again, it could be a rural advantage, so it's something to think about. And as the Chief mentioned with the community forums, 100 people isn't bad for us. You have something on a Tuesday night in Dixon and you get 100 people there, that's a pretty big turnout. And that really opened my eyes around the idea of how much interest there were, and perhaps even reluctantly, how much pain there was in the community or fear about this infecting the families that we serve.
In early May, the first week of May of 2015, one of the girls from Safe Harbor, who's been in recovery from a heroin addiction for 3 years now, asked the question, "You guys hear about the Gloucester chief who's creating a program where people come to the police department and they go to treatment instead of going to jail?" And we hadn't heard about it at the time, and it was in the planning stages. And so we put together a conference call, and we contacted Chief Capanello, and we talked to him and learned that on June 1st, so within a month, they were ready to launch their program. And just the basis and idea that people could come to the police department, turn in their drugs, turn in their drug paraphernalia, whatever they had, not fear any criminal arrest because they were coming to us and seeking help and instead being diverted directly to treatment. And, you know, when this was brought up by Allison, you know, everybody in the room just looked at each other and thought, that's a great idea. The question is, how do we get, we've tried to treat people in treatment before, how do we do that? How do we get those partnerships? How do we make that happen? But if it was happening in Gloucester, why couldn't it happen in Dixon, Lee County, Illinois? And so following that conversation with Chief Capanello and learning about their program, we began to strategize and create something that could be tailored to fit Dixon and Lee County. And we came up with three goals for this program. The first goal was to place people into treatment immediately when they came in if they were suffering from a heroin or opiate addiction. And I'm so proud to announce that through these partnerships and what we've done, we placed 70 people to treatment since September the 1st. And 70 people is a big number for Lee County. The second thing we wanted to do as a goal of the program was to really change the way law enforcement views and responds to addiction, and to create these public and private partnerships to help reduce the stigma. You know, since September 1st, we presented over 150 law enforcement agencies, and we're currently working with more than 30 police departments to help them implement programs just like this. And we're definitely available to do that with any department or area, for that matter. It isn't just police departments that have contacted us to look at different ideas and approaches. And then the third main goal was to really educate and establish partnerships with our lawmakers, with our legislatures, to get appropriate funding from the state, from the federal government, for treatment programs, because addiction is a disease, and to say it's not a crime, and to say as law enforcement and our partners, we hear you, we We can't jail people forever. We've got to get away from imprisoning people who don't need to be there. We strengthen their addiction. We increase their propensity for crimes and to step from property crimes to violence. And so, but we've got to put money here to have the resources to go the other way. And one of the problems we see in Illinois is that bare bones funding can equal bare bones treatment. And I think because of the system itself and looking at the issues within the system is why at times it takes 6 or 7 attempts at treatment for somebody to be successful. So we're really looking at ways to change that.
I congratulate all of you for investing an hour of your time to think about this topic. And if you only take one thing away from this workshop, I hope that it's the idea that don't try to do this on your own. I certainly didn't know where to turn from the hospital perspective, and engaging all of those agencies that you saw on the prior slide, as well as most importantly the local police department. Dixon wants to be a resource for you. There are other places out there that you can learn from, and there is no reason to reinvent the wheel. There's some real progress happening, and we want to help you jumpstart that if it's something that you believe would be beneficial for your communities.
Well, thanks, Dave. And to give an idea about how this is taking shape across the country, there are 100 programs. There's more than 100 programs now like this over 25 different states, which is incredible. This isn't a fly-by-night type of program. This is something that has shown stability, has shown the fact that it's here to stay, and has shown an incredible amount of success. One thing that's important when we look at getting people help in the treatment access is a major, major problem. And the stories, the horror stories we were hearing are that people have been on waiting lists for 3 and 4 weeks, that people would be calling 20, 30 places a day trying to find an opening. That they would go and spend an entire day doing assessments only at the end of the day to be told that there was no room for them or no bed for them, be it funding or whatever the case may be. And so there is a critical importance to immediate access of treatment when somebody is actively using heroin or opioids. And here's why. Because, first of all, they have to get to a point where they want the help. And so they get to that point where they want the help, and then they go and they find out it's just too difficult to get the help. And when they find out it's too difficult to get the help and they're not able to get in right away, then they start to face these horrible withdrawals from heroin and these opioid pain medications. It's been described as someone pulling your spine out of your back, intense vomiting, just pain throughout your entire body. So the only option that they see is to go back and continue using drugs. And the next time they're ready for help or ready to seek help might be the next day. It might be in a week or a month, or it might be never. It might be that they end up dead from an overdose. And the numbers and statistics we talked about are staggering there. There's really a 12 to 24-hour window. And we saw the same thing when we were developing informants for heroin and working these criminal investigations on the supply side. If we arrested somebody for using heroin who wanted to be an informant of the police, and we didn't start working with them immediately within that 12 to 24-hour range, they were right back to the drug. They were right back to using drugs, and the opportunity window was over. And we've seen the same exact thing, and through our conversations and research with people suffering from this addiction, how important that 12 to 24-hour window is. With our program, when somebody walks through the door and they need detox, we're generally placing them into treatment within 2 hours. And I'm going to talk about that, treatment access and treatment partners. Here are our treatment partners. We've got an incredible group of partners from our local hospital, our local outpatient treatment center, the treatment centers, you know, across central and northern Illinois, and even one in Florida. To establish these partnerships, first we got a list of high-quality treatment centers that came very well recommended. Working closely with KSB was incredibly important as we went to identify that list. And then we went out and we met with executive directors, coordinators of these treatment centers, toured the treatment centers, shared the vision, talked about the three goals, and it was incredible how quick. And that, we'll call you next week, but immediately in the meeting, with them saying, we will be your partner. We will give you a phone number that gives you immediate access to a decision maker, and we will take your people regardless of their ability to pay. And so as we move forward with this, that was a huge component of the program. Without those partnerships, none of this would be possible. So how does it work? This program is voluntary. We don't make anybody go to treatment. Somebody comes to the front door of the police or sheriff's department. Many times somebody comes into the emergency room. People can call in and ask for information. Ultimately, we go meet with the person. And when we meet with them, the first thing that has to happen is the officers have to be, you know, very caring, very compassionate. One of the things that our officers do is thank them for letting us help them. We call our volunteers, which we refer to as safe passage guides, to get somebody, and most of them people are in recovery or have somebody who suffers from addiction in their family, to come in and provide that care and support and compassion. It's so important with a program like this because there's a huge amount of anxiety that a person addicted to drugs and uses drugs goes through when they deal with the police. So it really is, and it's been described in some things as a legendary show of trust. So a police officer works with them. They complete a short three-page intake form. We look at what is their drug use history. We look at what is their mental health diagnosis, what are medical conditions. And based off that, we know which treatment partner is going to be the best fit. And then the officer contacts somebody, what we call a treatment liaison coordinator, and that person looks to find a good place for them to go. We do a warrant check and a criminal history check. We've never excluded anybody to this point who's wanted help, even if they had a warrant, because generally the warrants are for minor things. But we need to make sure we're not sending violent and dangerous people out with our volunteers or to these centers.
And also, of course, there's an appropriate medical screening if that person presents first to our emergency department or to one of our physicians within our medical group. So we go through all the necessary things to make sure the medical side is taken care of first, and when the patient is stable and assuming, as the chief said, that it's a voluntary situation, then the person is turned over to the program.
Thanks, Dave. And, you know, KSB has been an incredible partner. We realize that at times there might not be a treatment center that's immediately available. It's never happened, but there are times that it could happen, and KSB has worked with us to make sure we can provide a safe environment for people who don't have that immediate access.
The hospital does have a 13-bed inpatient psychiatric unit, which is a little bit rare in our area. We're the only inpatient unit within about a 60-mile radius now, and as you can imagine, it's sometimes difficult to admit because of bed availability. So we do have some resources that we can provide through our inpatient unit that might not be available at all rural hospitals. And there are a lot of stories if these people have to go to a med-surg bed, that's a difficult patient early on as they're going through some of this withdrawal.
The treatment spectrum is pretty straightforward, but it took a while because, most of us getting involved in this didn't have any background or experience in treatment. But there's several real key components in the pathway. Your detox, inpatient, intensive outpatient when they come out of detox, the regular outpatient treatment, and the support meetings. So nearly everybody that walks through our doors is struggling from heroin, from a heroin addiction. And so detox is that first step. We've got to get them through those withdrawals. And so the detox, depending on our partner, is a 3 to 5 day process. One thing that's important, though, is the coordination. I talked about some of the breakdown in the system. Treatment centers have detox beds open up much more rapidly than inpatient beds because detox is 3 to 5 days, and inpatient, traditionally in Illinois, is 28 days. And so what would normally happen when it's in the system is somebody would eventually get into detox, but then when they got out of detox, they'd be placed on a waiting list for 2, 3, 4 weeks. Well, that's a problem, and that's why it's taken people 6 to 7 times to get through treatment before it finally works. What we do is coordinate with our partners. So if somebody's getting out of detox and there's no inpatient bed available there, they will let us know that with a few days' notice because they'll know, and they will start looking for other places for the person to go, and we will start looking. And I would say in 95% of the time, we have coordinated the transfer and the placement to inpatient treatment. And through our volunteers, we provide transportation. The tricky part with the coordination from inpatient to outpatient is it's a longer period of time. And so keeping people focused that, okay, Rachel is coming up on a week away from being discharged from inpatient, to make sure that we have the intensive outpatient appointments set and ready with our partners, and to make sure that we have a volunteer assigned to the person when they're released so they know about the support meetings, so they're committed to the 90 meetings in 90 days, and that we get them to their intensive outpatient assessment right away to continue that process. Because if there's a gap there, or if somebody isn't working with them there, there's a real high chance there of relapse. And because there's clean, there's even a higher chance of overdose. And what we've found is if we're there to help hold their hand and coordinate it, the transition can be very smooth.
What Chief Langlois just described is very unusual. And in our world, in my world, when I heard that for the first time, I had some serious concerns regarding what sounds like some of the work that we expect from our discharge planners and from our social workers here in the hospital. It was unique to think of policemen serving as a contact point between the various levels of treatment. We took that through our medical staff. We took that through our legal counsel. And after we vetted all of it, we came down on the side of what's the best thing for the patient. And if there was not a true medical requirement that that person be admitted and the substance abuse was the key issue, then the system that Chief and his team put together was the best thing for the patient. And so far through the 70 cases that Danny has mentioned, it's been a completely favorable experience. But I'm guessing that many of you, when you heard that, you were thinking that's a different model than what you might have seen today.
So that's a good point, Dave. And we've developed a pretty comprehensive medical release, so we're able to communicate and coordinate with the different treatment centers and hospitals, partners that we're affiliated with, and that's been key. And so when I talk about that, there's no failure on the treatment center, but we've just been able to establish, because of the revolutionary approach that's being implemented here, a partnership that's just greater, that allows us to place people immediately. They move us to the top of their waiting list. At times they're creating beds that normally they wouldn't offer. And so people are really bending over backwards, and these partners are really bending over backwards to make this happen and to make it work. One question that's out there and gets asked a lot, it was the only negative that really came from this program, and after we described it, it was no longer negative, but how does this get paid for? Like, the police department shouldn't be paying for people's treatment. And the answer is, you're right, and we don't. We couldn't afford to do that. In Illinois, with the system that's set up, there's three main ways that treatment's funded. One is private insurance. The second is Medicaid to the state. And the third is DASA funding, which in Illinois is the Department of Alcohol and Substance Abuse. And so all of our treatment partners accept Medicaid, and almost all of them have DASA contracts. And what I will tell you, at least with our demographic in rural Lee County, is 90% of the people that have come through our program have been on Medicaid. Now, in Naperville, where they're creating a program in a much bigger community of over 100,000 people, well over 100,000 people, that a big base of their people suffering from heroin addiction have private insurance. Because they're dealing with people from affluent families and kids between the ages of 18 to 22. So it really depends on your area and what it is.
And it's important for you to know that our Medicaid percentage at KSB Hospital is 17%. So I think we're in a very typical community.
Thanks, Dave. One of the keys, and we look at, it's great to get people to treatment. It's great to get them to inpatient. But if we don't have a plan for aftercare, then all of it really is for naught. And that coordination in the process and going the extra mile, I've heard people say, well, we shouldn't have to do that. And I think in life there's a lot of things we shouldn't have to do. But if we're, I always talk about, and Dave and I have talked about this a lot, is the best way to predict the future is to create it. And when we began with the end in mind, the success we wanted to see, it wasn't a matter, nothing along that line is, well, we shouldn't have to do that. It's what do we have to do to get to that goal, to get to that end.
What was so amazing to me is the first meetings that we had all began with what we could not do. We heard all the no's, and I was part of that. I went to liability. I went to how our medical staff would view it. I went to how it would impact our discharge planners. And to Danny's credit, we were able to work through all of that, and we just knocked them off one by one. But if you decide to take on a journey like this, the first few steps, you're going to have a lot of wins in your face, and you have to fight through that in order to get to where your community needs you to be.
Well, I think one of the big things is that you've got to bring in the movers and shakers. You know, you've got to be strategic and not only who your partnerships are with the health department, but our health department administrator is one of the biggest go-getters that I've ever met. She's the president of the Illinois Health Department Coalition, and she's done an amazing job at keeping the group focused. Because if it's not structured well and if it's not set up well, you'll lose those partners like we do a lot of times. And so having that high focus and structure, beginning with the end, and really creating a roadmap based on the four pillars is the key to a lot of the success, you know, with this program. And again, the partnerships. We truly are reshaping the war on drugs. It is a community-based approach. There's no way you can address the four pillars as just the hospital, as just the health department, as just the police department, as just the faith-based community. But there is incredible power when you bring the right people to the table with the right mindset and attitude. And we're just firm believers, and Dave and I really shared the idea that anything we decide to put our mind to, we can accomplish. And we never ask why not, or, you know, we ask how. You know, we never say, well, this won't work because of this. We say, how can we make this work? And when you get good people around the table, it's just incredible what you can bring to life.
This is a problem that none of us want to talk about or want to have in our communities. It's not something from a service line approach that rural hospitals are used to dealing with or getting involved with. To me, it's a statement of mission around the mission of our hospital and what is our community asking for us. We see firsthand in our emergency department, in our inpatient psychiatric unit, the devastation that addiction has, not only on the patient, but on the family and the friends of the person that's involved. And it's worth taking a risk. We still have a long way to go, and I began the conversation today talking about, I think we're at the beginning of a success story. There probably is no end to this, and as the chief said earlier on, all indications tell us that the problem is not going away anytime soon, and we want to give our community members the best chance that they can. We want to offer to all of you the opportunity to try to help with that if you're in a similar situation. That concludes our presentation, Rebecca. So with that, I would turn it over to you for any questions that might come from the call.